Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. Across the U.S., students are mobilizing in defense of Palestinian rights and in direct opposition to their university administration's relationships with Israeli institutions and investments in corporations that aid and abet Israel's genocide in Gaza. Israel lobby groups have mounted escalating attacks on students who support Palestinian liberation and have worked with university administrations to crack down on student activism and speech. At the end of October last year, when Israel's genocidal attacks on Gaza were already in full swing, the Anti-Defamation League and the Louis D. Brandeis Center, two of the top right-wing Israel lobby and lawfare groups in the U.S. masquerading as civil rights organizations, sent letters to hundreds of U.S. universities urging administrators to, quote, immediately investigate their campus chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine over, quote, potential violations of the prohibition against materially supporting a foreign terrorist organization. Just a few weeks ago, the ADL's director, Jonathan Greenblatt, compared the Palestinian keffiyeh, the traditional scarf worn by Palestinians and people around the world who support Palestinians, to the Nazi swastika on national TV without any pushback by the television hosts. Earlier this year, the Columbia University Administration suspended the campus chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace. And then in early April, after students organized an event focused on Palestine, the administration suspended five students and issued eviction orders from student housing with only 24 hours notice. At Pomona University in Southern California in early April, The Guardian reported that 18 students were arrested and charged with misdemeanor trespassing, and one student was arrested for obstruction of justice, according to the Claremont Police Department, during a protest in response to the removal of pro-Palestinian art on the college campus. Students were led away by dozens of cops in riot gear. The Guardian added that at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, at the same time, three students were expelled, one suspended, and 20 were given probation over their involvement in a sit-in protest on March 27th for Palestine at the campus's Kirkland Hall. The protest was in response to the school administration removing an Israel divestment question from student ballots. And repression by administrators at Harvard has reached unprecedented levels, students say, where every Palestine-related event is under intense scrutiny by the administration, and student leaders have been evicted and investigated by the university. In February, the MIT administration suspended the Coalition Against Apartheid for fighting for Palestinian liberation. They have further issued sanctions letters to 13 student organizers, threatening them with permanent suspension from MIT. And at the University of Pennsylvania, students faced possible administrative discipline for screening a documentary on Zionism. There are so many other instances across the U.S. on college campuses, it's hard to keep up. But joining us today are four students from Harvard, Columbia, MIT, and the University of Pennsylvania. Safiya Ogundipe is a senior at MIT studying chemical biological engineering and has been an organizer with the MIT Coalition Against Apartheid since 2021. Leah Kayali is a student organizer at Harvard Law School and community organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement in Boston. Her family is from the occupied interior of Palestine. They were exiled in 1948. We have Sabira from the University of Pennsylvania, who is in her junior year and has been a part of the fight in advocating for Palestine on her campus. And Kay from Columbia, who wishes to remain anonymous because of the mounting attacks, both from the administration and Israel-aligned groups. Welcome all of you to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
So I want to go around and have you each lay out what's been happening on your campuses in terms of both Israel lobby repression, administrative repression, and how students have been organizing to fight back. Leah, let's begin by having you talk about what's been happening at Harvard Law School.
Sure. So I go to Harvard Law School, and in coalition with students at the other Harvard campuses, we've been organizing since you know, since October against the genocide on our campuses and have seen severe repression from the university. As you mentioned, you know, friends of mine have been removed from their housing, from their positions of employment from the university, have faced investigation both by law enforcement and by the university police. And so we've seen real escalations in response to oftentimes very mild protests. You know, I'm under investigation by the disciplinary board of the law school. So just in response to speaking in the student lounge at our school. So we've seen like that, even this, you know, extreme level of repression against, you know, the most mild of dissent. And I really think the reason for that is because these institutions, and I'll just speak to Harvard in particular, are deeply embedded in and bought into the death cult of Zionism. And so I think when we talk about repression, and when you look at the picture of Harvard in particular, the intervention I think is important for people to understand, and that I would want to make here is that, you know, Harvard is invested not just materially, financially, but academically and intellectually in the project of Zionism in a way that sort of leaves them no choice but to, you know, cow to every Zionist attack that we've seen happen in the last 6 months. And, you know, you could take any one of the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of catastrophes that have been wrought upon my people. And if you were to trace it back, you know, you would see Harvard's fingerprints all over it. A friend of mine recently told me the story of his, you know, childhood friend whose son was martyred after just, you know, going to his room to pick up his toys. And then that particular room was struck by a bomb. And because it was in the area of the Ashifa medical complex, that family couldn't leave their home and was forced to be in the room with their son's rotting body for 4 days. If you take even just this one example of something that feels personal to me through a friend, you know, you think about the bomb that was dropped might have been an Elbit Hermes drone, and Elbit is poaching employees from Harvard. You think about the Israeli military officials who okayed that bomb, and they maybe are people who are beneficiaries of the Wexner Fellowship at Harvard. Then you look at the American side, the politicians that approved those sort of targeted killings and, you know, allow for the military budgets and military funding packages to go through. Statistically, any large number of them are Ivy League educated, including at Harvard, Anthony Blinken, obviously being an example of someone who went to Harvard. And so I just mentioned that to say that when we look at the level of repression that students are facing on campus, we can see that it is because of Harvard's investment, which is why our demand as student organizers has been divest, but also to think of divestment expansively, not only in the way that all capital is often invested in genocide being wrought upon my people, but also the way that Harvard has provided political and intellectual cover for Zionism as it continues to commit these crimes for the last 6 months. So that's really been what our organizing has been centered around. We did pass a divestment resolution at the law school, and they have been following it at other graduate schools at Harvard. The undergraduate recently tried to put a divestment bill forward, and it was actually blocked by just a few Zionist forces in the administration and student government, very undemocratically. So we're seeing this repression happen to students, and it's really because of the investments that Harvard has, which is why our call remains to divest materially and academically from Zionism.
Phenomenal. Thank you so much, Leah. Sophia, you're very close to where Leah goes to school at MIT. You're a senior there. You've been organizing for several years. Talk about what's happening at MIT. I mean, you know, it's just, I mean, and all four of you are students of very elite, you know, Ivy League institutions that purport to be, you know, beacons of academic freedom and democratic thought. And, you know, what has it been like organizing for Palestine on MIT's campus? What have you been facing?
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. On the sort of idea of these colleges, you know, espousing these sorts of values, I think at MIT, when you walk into like Lobby 7, which is like our main lobby, there are these like giant banners that like show like MIT's values. I think it's like belonging, curiosity, something like that, which is interesting because and we had a protest there in November. The administration's response to our, you know, curiosity and our sense of community was to threaten almost 100 students in there with suspensions. So obviously there's a bit of a hypocritical element to the image that these institutions like to purport about themselves and what they're actually doing. But yeah, in terms of the organizing at MIT, we've been, you know, doing things around genocide since October. We put out a statement pretty early on, engaged in some of the Boston area protests, and then started having protests on our own campus. I think a lot of our campaign at MIT, just given the technical nature of MIT and how embedded we are in like producing technology for not only the US war machine, but for Israel, has been focusing on those research and technology ties. So right now we have been really looking at MIT's research relationships with Israel. So MIT receives millions of dollars in research funding from the Israeli Ministry of Defense, like directly from the Israeli Ministry of Defense. Like you go onto like our like vice president of research, you go onto like the like report they put out at the end of each year, and it's literally the Israeli Ministry of Defense is like giving money to researchers, to faculty at MIT to do projects. And these are not innocent projects. I mean, they wouldn't be innocent regardless, but like we're talking like autonomous robotic swarms. We're talking underwater persistent monitoring. And this is money that is coming directly from the Zionist entity through the Department of Defense in the US and then into MIT. And these researchers are doing these projects with that funding. And so there's this very explicit relationship that MIT has where we are producing like the technological capabilities, both through research that is directly funded by the Israeli entity, but also just generally, like we have so much technology, so much of MIT is funded by the Department of Defense. And a lot of that technology will still end up benefiting the Zionist entity. And so that is something we've been focusing on a lot at MIT, is how do we as students and workers, so both undergraduates, a lot of undergraduates do research, but grad workers especially do a lot of research. How do we kind of take back that power and say like, no, we're not going to allow our labor to be used for genocide, to be used for occupation. So we released this Scientists Against Apartheid pledge. I think right now we have over 1,000 people signed on to it. That includes about 500 undergraduates, which is like 12% of the undergraduate population at MIT, which is great. And it's really just about like saying to the Institute, like, you know, no, you cannot use, you know, this labor force to continue to push this project of Zionism out into the world. And so that's one campaign we've been doing. Another campaign that we've been looking at, because I mean, MIT just has so much complicity, is also another issue. That was something we always struggled with even before October 7th, is like, what do we focus on? And I think the Israeli Ministry of Defense funding was one thing that we really wanted to hit on. The second one was this Lockheed Martin seed fund for Israel that faculty can apply for, where they can collaborate with a researcher in Israel to basically just, you know, start some sort of seed project. The money comes from Lockheed Martin. They prioritize projects that work with UAVs, that work with quantum sensing, all of the sorts of things that Lockheed Martin would want. And it's been really interesting campaigning against this specific fund, because we've been accused of, oh, you're targeting the manager of this fund because he's Israeli. And so now we're going to investigate you guys on anti-Semitism and on harassment based on protected class, which are two charges, which are the charges that I'm currently dealing with. You have the people who like manage the fund claiming like, oh, it's not a fund of war or of genocide. It's actually a fund for climate change. The projects that we choose are for climate change. And so then you have this like greenwashing of a fund that is funded by Lockheed Martin to do research with Israeli researchers that prioritizes fields such as UAVs and quantum sensing. And they're gonna tell us it's a climate fund. And so there's this kind of culture at MIT that we're also kind of pushing against. That is kind of unique because we're such an engineering and technology heavy school. And so I think it's been really interesting to see students push back on just our overall culture, not just with our relationship to Zionists, but our relationship to war and genocide throughout. But in terms of repression, so as you kind of mentioned, we had a rally in February. It was right after there were right after some attacks in Rafah, like February 11th, February 12th, somewhere around there. And so we had an emergency rally. And MIT basically, after that rally, they suspended the CIA and they sent sanction letters to 13 organizers. We managed to get it dropped down to 8 eventually, basically saying, you break another rule, we will have grounds to permanently suspend you. And that was kind of interesting because we're also dealing with this sort of new protest policy that's been rolled out this year, which is basically that you have to register your protests like 3 business days in advance. You have to like pick one of these approved protest locations, and they so conveniently dropped the list of approved protest locations the day before we were about to have a protest in a non-approved protest location. And so we're also kind of dealing with that side of things of, you know, how do we continue to push back against this protest policy? Because this is not something that will just affect us. If we allow this new protest policy to stay in effect without any sort of pressure against it, like that's going to affect student activists going forward. But yeah, in terms of repression, so there are the sanction letters, which actually the sanction letters that came after the Rafah rally, we actually managed to basically clear. They've kind of gotten rid of those, which are good. But we still have 7 students under investigation from back in January, myself included, for a protest that we did against that Lockheed Martin fund that I was talking about earlier. And that protest was in November. And then we got the sanction letters in January, like a day after Claudine Gay resigned from Harvard. And there have been a couple of instances where we'll see an instance of repression on our campus very soon after something else happens on another campus, and they'll always tell us it's not related. But you know, we know that administrators talk just like we talk. And so, yeah, that's the main thing that we're dealing with. We've had some instances relating to the police. Luckily, nothing to the level that we're seeing at, you know, Pomona or even locally at Brandeis. We've kind of been following those, and our hearts are with those students who are kind of facing that level of brutality. But there has been like increased police presence on campus. There's a police officer stationed in Lobby 7 in that main lobby that I mentioned. He's stationed there all day, every weekday. We had a teach-in back in the fall semester that was totally registered, totally just a purely educational event. They ended up locking the doors and stationing 3 police officers in front of it right after the protest that we had. And they really gave no justification as to why they did that. Of course, we know why they did that. They basically just wanted to shut us up after that protest that we had in November. But I think police presence is also something that is really galvanizing the student base at MIT because, you know, groups like the Black Students Union and the Black Graduate Student Association have been fighting for years to try to reduce the level of police presence at MIT and get rid of cops in emergency situations on campus. And basically all it took was a couple of Zionist students to complain about our protests, and now there are cops everywhere. There's cops by the Religious Activity Center. There's a cop stationed in Lobby 7. There's just way more cop presence on campus. And so it's kind of interesting to see which student voices get thing that the administration immediately responds to. Because like I said, almost every community of color has complained about the cops before. We had whole committees that they put these students through to come up with these recommendations to try to reduce the presence of cops on campus. And it took the span of like 3 months for that to be completely undone and then some because of Zionist students who want to quash our protests. And so we're seeing these connections between not just people who are struggling for Palestine, but also a lot of the struggles that like Black students and other students of color have been fighting for on campus. And so I don't know, it's been interesting. Obviously the repression is not great, but it has been a really good opportunity to sort of coalition build in a very material way and in a very real way that I don't think has existed on campus before. And I think admin is not quite ready for the level of students collaboration that they're probably going to have to deal with in the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Thanks, Sophia. Sabira, you're at the University of Pennsylvania. Tell us what's been happening there in terms of both student activism around the genocide in Gaza and also administrative repression.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and then also for everyone who spoke before. It's interesting because a lot of these themes and acts of suppression have been just present on our campus as well. It definitely seems that like you know, all of our suppression and repression are interconnected, especially on the front of over-policing, targeting of students for just the premise of being pro-Palestine, especially because Penn started to get a lot of the heat after Harvard, after other schools. We were able to protect ourselves in very, you know, cautious manners, especially as our comrades and like fellow organizers from Harvard, like got a lot of the brunt of the violence. Penn Against Occupation, the main SJP adjacent group on campus, had released a statement very soon after the like the acts of resilience on October 7th. And many student groups had signed on, but considering the doxing that happened at Harvard, obviously many students had to protect themselves and obviously, you know, not risk, you know, their entire safety. Many students, especially undocumented students on our campus, have been specifically doxed or put in very uncomfortable situations. It's very interesting on our campus. It's actually not just been the university that has put students in uncomfortable positions, but students themselves have, especially from the Zionist student groups and spaces on campus. Specifically for myself, I've been studying abroad for the last year and haven't been able to physically be on the ground to actually advocate and organize. But being someone who is concerned and especially like very, very shocked about the response from my university community about the genocide happening in Gaza, that's undeniably a genocide. Like students have been preying on each other's social media, talking to each other, particularly from the Zionist community, in order to actually attack and give names and identify students, even if they aren't directly a part of student groups, which is really concerning, considering that although I haven't been on campus to specifically organize, my name was added onto a list of students that were put on Canary Mission amongst other websites and have faced like violent threats to my own family, as young as like my six-year-old cousins being given very violent threats, which is unjust. And the university still hasn't, you know, responded to that, which is really, really concerning. Similar to Safia, it's very interesting because Zionist students have been able to complain that they have felt uncomfortable by mere acts of saying free Palestine or let Gaza live, very simple and, you know, not, well, free Palestine has been controversial, but let Gaza live, you know, of people living in their home, which shouldn't be controversial. It has caused a very easy way for the disciplinary committee at Penn to just get names of students and force a disciplinary case on them. As many of the Zionist students who have been very loud and proud of the growing anti-Semitism on our campus by scapegoating specific students, specific groups, specific actions to the smallest extent to give students disciplinary cases. One of which was really concerning, that was students have been identified from mere security footage for putting stickers on, you know, poles on campus that say free Palestine, let Gaza live, simple, you know, slogans and, you know, statements. And students have been given disciplinary cases by that, just by identifying them due to specific like clothes that they have worn repeatedly. The university definitely has cracked down on certain students and is not willing to discriminate those students based on simple actions. There's actually been a very concerning situation that happened recently where students were simply chalking on campus, and active chalking is used by many student groups, you know, to promote upcoming shows, you know, promote, you know, elections that are happening, anything like that. But students, a part of the pro-Palestine groups on our campus, were swarmed by 6 to 8 campus police officers and detained, you know, unjustifiably for 30 minutes until other students had shown up in solidarity to just say, like, what is the issue? campus security wouldn't budge, and they were asking for identification. But knowing our rights as students, saying that we're violating and damaging the school property, the property that we pay for. By the way, it was spray chalk. You know, you can just pour water on it, and it'll be gone. Detaining students on their campus, that's very unsafe. And even after this, students were followed home. That's very dangerous about, considering on Penn's campus, students are required to live on campus for 2 years. Our home is our campus, and if we're followed home, how can you be safe? Especially considering the growing disciplinary cases of students being rejected housing, like losing their housing because of their advocacy. Are we students, or are we just, pawns to the liberal agenda of what seems like liberal education, which I find really concerning. I didn't mention what I study, but I do study Middle Eastern politics. And there have been cases where students in classes have specifically been called out and been reported to disciplinary cases based on something they said in class. If we in our classrooms can't feel safe to speak our mind, to call it a genocide, what it is, to say that Palestinians deserve the right to live, to the right to talk about the right of resistance, the right to freedom, and all these liberal ideas that we all talk about every single day. You know, we talk about South Africa, we talk about all these different liberty movements, especially on our campus. Penn is placed in the black bottom of Philadelphia, and we have indigenous acknowledgments and talking about the black people who are displaced and ongoingly displaced in our community. But if we talk about these lofty ideals but actually can't act on them during an actual genocide, it's really concerning, considering also Penn has a direct relation with certain programs in the West Bank where students from Palestine actually are part of our community. This isn't a separate idea where students, there are no Palestinian students on our campus, that there are just only Palestinians from the diaspora. There are actually Palestinian students from Palestine on our campus that are suffering, being scared and put into silence, who lack support. And it's really concerning. It's been a very wide-ranging idea of disciplinary cases, where a really concerning recent instance was when through a very mild act of resistance, a study-in where students had just booked a GSR or a study room in our main library, we only had put flags and banners alongside the walls so people could obviously not pretend that they're in a world that the genocide isn't occurring, to keep the awareness running. Students were studying silently. And during the study session, administration had come to the room to ask for the flyers and the banners and the flags to be taken down. Students had complied, but despite this, students during that study-in are now facing escalated disciplinary hearings that are not just solved by what normally happens is an essay kind of talking about the situation, but now they're being forced into a hearing to actually, talk about the seriousness of just studying in a room and having a flag up, just because some Zionist students were complaining about how it made them uncomfortable. The real reality of the situation is that Penn is not absolved from the hands of the violence and, from the West Bank to Gaza to the pre-1948 territories. Penn actively manufactures, innovates, engineers the newest technology used to police, surveil, and, murder innocent Palestinians in the homeland. Recently, a new campaign that's been going on is to target Pennovation, that actually is famously known for engineering the robotic war dogs. I don't know the specific language, but they're known for having engineered the robotic dogs that are used to monitor and surveil Palestinians. And although this has been a larger campaign, not just on our campus, but from the entire concerned Philadelphia community, the university has specifically barred from our main SJP group, Penn Against Occupation, from endorsing this action because it risks, similarly to other campuses, our recognition as a student society, because if we are able to endorse this action, we're suddenly going against campus violations. But last time I checked, advocating and standing in our grounds for our values, I don't know how that's against university violation when we have six and more Zionist groups and they're able to blatantly call student advocacy groups anti-Semitic for advocating for Palestinians or just deny the genocide outwardly. There have been a lot of occurrences that have been really concerning, including like a recent leaked chat of Zionist students calling organizers and attendees of a Palestine protest animals that they wish threats and harm upon students that were there. This was leaked with their names, and administration has lacked to act on that. So there are a lot of different instances that are really concerning, not just about administration repressing students and advocacy, but other students themselves inflicting harm on other students. And it's really difficult because a lot of our campus are sympathetic and aware of the genocide, but because of the strong voices of the, you know, the Zionist community at Penn, a lot of students have been forced into silence, have been unable to advocate for themselves, advocate for Palestine, to feel proud and, you know, proud, like Palestinian students to be proud in their Palestinian identity. Many of them who have removed themselves from the entire genocide because they're afraid of being targeted. It causes this really difficult witch hunt on campus.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Sabira. And Kay, you're at Columbia University. Since January, there have been the most egregious attack. There was an actual chemical attack on students by former members of the Israeli military. Quite a story in itself. You also have a very anti-Palestinian professor, Shai Davidai, who has been doxing and attacking students and has yet to face any administrative sanctions or discipline at all. And now the university has evicted and suspended students involved in Palestine organizing. Walk us through the last, 4 to 6 months on Columbia University campus.
Right. So repression at Columbia has been so crazy, where it's like I have tried to remember everything that's happened. I'm still like forgetting certain things, like even the attack from January. That was like a lot of times, like around when I'm talking like my fellow organizers at Columbia, we like sometimes forget that happened. Even like the students who were like victims of it, like there's just so much that's happened. It's just like we just forget about it. But yeah, so most of the repression that we're getting, like, we're facing mounting repression from the administration, mostly because, you know, President Manoush Shafiq is going to be appearing at Congress soon this week. And she was charged by the Education Committee of not, like, properly dealing with campus anti-Semitism, which is, you know, just a code word for active pro-Palestine student organizing, because here on the Columbia campus, we've really been active across all different schools, across the undergraduate and graduate schools. And just to start, one thing that happened, I don't know if this was very publicized, but we had some pro-Palestine law students hold a vigil in their cafeteria, and that escalated to the administration demonizing these students as anti-Semitic, simply because some Zionists overheard them reading out the names of martyrs. That is literally the entire issue. They said a vigil was anti-Semitic. And so another thing is the university also publicized and demonized a post that Quad posted on their Instagram story, and this only happened because of Zionist outrage. And so another thing that also happened is the university launched disciplinary cases against students who had passed out pamphlets that concerned the university's trustees, you know, basically saying how each trustee, their role at Columbia and how their relationship to Zionism. And so most of these trustees are not Jewish, but the pamphlets were misconstrued as anti-Semitic by Zionists, and that's why the university launched these disciplinary cases against these students who gave them out, and they even targeted random students who had nothing to do with these pamphlets, who were not involved in the passing out or the making of these pamphlets at all. But I think with the turning point here at Columbia is that the fact that the university hired a COO, the first in its history to deal with us, and that's led to really ridiculous tactics such as one, emailing all of the student groups in Columbia University Apartheid Divest, which is a coalition of over 100 groups. And so the administration emailed these student group leaders with threats of associating with us, basically saying this group is doing so-and-so that we determined is like violent and unsafe and anti-Semitic. And this is all an effort to get these student groups to disaffiliate with us, basically to make our coalition crumble. It's really all just an effort to destroy the movement, the student movement that we have going here.
And what is the what does the COO stand for?
The Chief Operating Officer, I believe.
Okay, but that person has been hired specifically to monitor Palestine solidarity organizers on campus.
They don't say so publicly, but in all of these threats that I'm detailing, even like the threats against the students that got them suspended, that person's name was on every email. So we basically think that they were hired to get Manusha Feek to keep her job. Another instance is the university also attempted to intimidate students out of attending a legitimate student worker union protected protest before the protest occurred, as well as after, where they sent threatening, confusing letters to render students they could identify from mass surveillance on campus, which they do through public safety, following students around, through cameras that they've placed new cameras around campus as well. And they've also, every time there's like a protest or any kind of like pro-Palestine activity, what they do is they close the gates. What that means is that if you can only like go onto campus if you have a Columbia ID, because usually you can just go on campus, no questions asked. So when you go onto campus, when the gates are closed, you have to tap your ID on an electric scanner. And so the university uses that to identify students who are coming and going. That is also part of their mass surveillance on campus. And that's how they were able to identify students who attended this protest and like be able to send them threatening letters. But that's only for Columbia. At Barnard, students actually got notices for disciplinary meetings with their deans or whatever for a disciplinary process for attending this these protests, simply because Barnard College, which is affiliated with Columbia, but technically its own university, is quite more harsh against protests, students who who attend protests either on Columbia campus or on Barnard campus. And one thing I'd like to clarify is that this is all a distraction. The university does not want us to talk about Gaza or about Palestine at all. Instead, it presents these issues in our lives so that we only talk about these issues. So, you know, when we go to protest, all we're talking about is like the repression instead of like what's going on in Gaza, what's going on in Palestine, what's going on in Rafah. And that's even just before I talk about the suspensions and evictions. And so what this university is doing is that it's making students homeless and wrecking their education simply for exercising our First Amendment rights. But to make it worse, in like really to show that this is all a farce, is the fact that Manusha Feek quickly made a statement against the suspended students, you know, quicker than when students were sprayed with the chemical in January. And so in the statement, she caricatured them as violent and dangerous, basically inviting law enforcement against these students on baseless charges. And this is quite dangerous because a vast majority of our organizers are people of color, are Black people, are Arabs, Muslims. And so this university is just shamelessly deciding to engage in structural racism and Islamophobia.
Indeed. Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. So we really see this. This is all because of Shafiq's upcoming appearance in front of Congress. And this is really her last attempt to show Congress that she's a serious disciplinarian against pro-Palestine students. And this is just all some strange effort to keep her job at the expense of the people she's supposed to support and protect. And so because this is like unlike any repression we student organizers have ever faced since October 7th, we think that this is not going to end well for Columbia's reputation, because, you know, who will want to send their kids to a university that menaces its students like this?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just unbelievable. I mean, just, you know, the fact that students were attacked in an incredibly harmful and dangerous way with a chemical spray in January. I remember reading the testimony of one of the students who was attacked, and she was talking about how it was taking weeks to get the smell out of her clothes and off of her body, and how it was affecting all sorts of her health for weeks, and the administration completely ignored it, and instead of trying to, you know, find and discipline the people who sprayed these students, they just punished the students. It's just, it's not surprising in a certain way when we see the decades and decades of university administrations around the U.S. and Canada, who have willingly thrown their own students under the bus in order to preserve, you know, their investments in Israeli companies or U.S. companies that are involved in Israeli occupation, or to preserve their relationships with Israeli universities that are involved in, like what you were talking about, Safia, these actual material relationships where, you know, U.S. universities and Israeli universities are working to develop these incredibly lethal and dystopian weapons. So it's not shocking, but it's not surprising, but it is shocking that these administrations are still at this point willing to throw their students under the bus in order to preserve their donors, preserve these relationships. It's extraordinary. Leah, you know, at Harvard, how have you talked a little bit about this, but how have students been? This is Harvard Law, you know, training the next generation of lawyers, and here's like a perfect case study. How has the law students, student body been organizing against this administrative repression, and what kind of also, like, you know, legal help have you been getting? There are organizations, of course, like Palestine Legal, like the Center for Constitutional Rights, like the ACLU, which I know has also been helping at Columbia. What kind of student organizing have you been involved in?
Yeah, so I think we've seen that these, I can't remember who was speaking about like this idea of protest guidelines. We've seen that here at Harvard Law as well. The concept of protest guidelines has really just become a bludgeon with which these universities can batter dissent, and particularly pro-Palestinian dissent. And so the problem with trying to strangle law students with policy is that we are trained to read and adapt policy. I think one of the strategies we took was to sort of try to expose the discriminatory enforcement of these policies, right? So for example, we've seen that every administrator at Harvard, right? These are people who are at the height of their careers as, academic administrators, right? Deans, things like that. All of these people have been deputized to respond to Zionist tattletales, right? So every time there's more than like three people wearing keffiyehs sitting around in the student lounge talking about Palestine, you're almost certainly going to have a dean come down and tell you that this is not a normal use of space, right? To uninvite you, essentially. And so to expose the racism of this, one thing that we did was sort of highlight how actually it's very normal for students to be engaging in political conversations, to be expressing dissent vocally on campus. That's a necessary and critical part of academic discourse. And so, for example, in this main student lounge, which has kind of become the contested site of a lot of our organizing at Harvard Law, the Women's Law Student Association had like a very benign Valentine's card making event in the lounge. And then we had like a Palentine's card making event like a week later, where people delivered wrote messages about the importance of divestment and standing up against the genocide and delivered those to the deans. But that event, the deans were sent down to say that we couldn't make we couldn't, you know, make cards in this space, right? and I think it really, like, these things really expose that there's no adult in the room, right? There's no adult in these administrative proceedings. People are really just bending to the whim of Zionist pressure, coming sometimes just from students, from donors, probably from other folks that have influence over Harvard. We know, obviously, Congress. So all of that is to say that we would do things like this to sort of expose the hypocrisy. And then what we're seeing is that the university has taken a really sharp right veer into fascism and has actually suppressed all ability to have organic, discourse on campus, to have any sort of protest, have any sort of event. So, you know, when their discriminatory enforcement was exposed, they said, fine, no one can use the space except for quiet reflection and study. And so I think these have been ways that we've tried to show how everyone on campus is a stakeholder in this, even if, you know, while everyone absolutely should be doing something about the genocide, even folks whose passions are maybe in another area of social change, like, we all have an interest in making sure that we're able to have the breathing room to express dissent and change on our campus that we really don't have right now. And I think what this shows is that, you know, these universities, right, like Kay mentioned, the closing of the gates at Columbia, that's something that's happened at Harvard too. The gates have been closed. And it really exposes the McCarthyist capacity of these academic institutions completely disregard all of the values that Sophia was talking about, right? The values of academic freedom and expression, diversity and inclusion, to just throw those off the table the second it becomes inconvenient for them. And as soon as it's politically expedient for them to tamp down on all of those students that they're putting on their glossy brochures, they'll do that, right? So I think, you know, exposing the discriminatory nature of the policies and the enforcement, highlighting how the repression that, you know, we call it the Palestinian exception, but really it's like, you know, the canary in the coal mine. So, you know, highlighting that repression of Palestinian speech is only leading to this, you know, dystopian reality that we're in, where campus has become this like bizarre quiet zone where no one can say anything publicly without facing repression. The university wants us to be sort of sequestered into these bookable spaces and private rooms and studies, but discourse happens publicly, right? No one can escape the moral imperative to do something about a genocide, and that conversation needs to happen in public. It can't happen behind closed doors. It can't happen behind room bookings, and so that's a necessary part of campus discourse. And it's not one thing I do also kind of want to problematize. It's not the idea of like free speech for the sake of free speech, right? Like, we engage in protests and dissent publicly on campus and think that everyone should, because we are invested in a different world than the one Harvard is invested in. We are invested in a world where all people, including my people in Palestine, can live in freedom and dignity and in liberation, in a world where we evade climate catastrophe, in a world where we don't have a prison and a military industrial complex, right? All of these things are things that students are, the future that students are invested in, but it's not the one Harvard's invested in. And we're seeing the discrepancy between those investments become really clear in the way that we've organized on campus.
Thanks, Leah. And yeah, Kay, I want to go back to you because, kind of the same question I asked Leah, like, what are the ways in which students are organizing around this, like, just kind of avalanche of repression on campus, and how, I mean, I mentioned the ACLU in New York, along with Palestine Legal, sent their intention to Columbia, saying, like, what you're doing, this kind of repression against students is completely absurd. And violates their basic civil rights. How are those conversations going? And has the repression at Columbia effectively silenced students? Like, has it achieved the effect that the administration and these like very racist Zionist individuals and organizations want? Has it made students speak out less, or what's happened?
Right. So I think one thing we've been doing is trying to, we have this kind of motto is that we keep ourselves safe. And so like first, before even we go to, even before we like go to like lawyers and stuff like that, we try to make things safe, not just for like each other as student organizers, but also like our pro-Palestine students, our pro-Palestine classmates who are, you know, not as involved, but still really care. And so we try to like set up like different like small little task force for different things, like for example, like any kind of, if any kind of disciplinary cases goes out against like, you know, like random students, we try to like get in contact with them and give them kind of like tips, like and also like support, and so that's one way we've been trying to keep ourselves safe. I would say that the repression has instilled some fear in us, but it hasn't like silenced us. It's just like given us something else to consider when we're like planning things, even like the littlest of things. So, like we're like, we know that there's going to be a reaction to this, even if it's just something very small. And so we try to keep that in mind. So I wouldn't say that it has like stopped us or silenced us, but it has made things probably more difficult to be an organizer. And so I'd say on the legal front, we do have quite a lot of support from lawyers. But it has been quite frustrating because we feel that they're not, you know, happening as fast as we want them to, or they're not as like effective as we wish they were, but we are still trying to, you know, come at this repression at all angles. And that's something that I think has been really important and is probably the one thing that's going to like end this repression.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that. Safia, the same question to you. How are our students organizing? And I don't remember if you mentioned there was a sit-in at MIT. I mean, you know, it was probably back in November or December. It feels like it was a decade ago already. You know, has the student body, you know, this 12% that you talked about who are absolutely against this genocide and against MIT's material involvement from working with Israeli, you know, weapons contractors. How have they been organizing? Have students, I mean, you're under investigation yourself. What even does that look like? How are you and your comrades taking measures to protect yourselves and protect your academic freedom and protect the right to organize against genocide at MIT?
Yeah, so there's a couple of components to it. But I'll start with the sit-in that we had in November, which was interesting because it kind of became a larger thing than I think even we were intending it to be. Basically, we were doing this action. It was like one of the first like shut it down for Palestine days. And so this was our thing that we were going to do for it, as well as to bring attention to this Lockheed Martin fund that I had been talking about. And we were just going to sit in the lobby. We had people's like set up to be marshals to prevent, to, you know, to like help with safety. We agreed that we wouldn't explicitly block anyone from going into the hallways. So like a very mundane protest, basically for like the first 2 hours, it was just people like sitting and like studying in like the lobby, like in this open lobby that like things have happened in at MIT forever. Like random musical groups will just like sing in the lobby. You know what I mean? Like it's very much like an open space. I had one faculty describe it as like our Times Square. You know, so for them to say that like protests are not allowed there is like a bit ahistorical. But we had that sit-in or that, you know, sort of action. And then we had the counter protesters coming in about 2 hours in. That's what kind of caused a lot of the energy to go up. A lot of people were, you know, verbally harassed. You know, we were shouted like very obscene and derogatory things. A lot of the women and femme-presenting people were shouted at very obscene things. A lot of the Arab and Palestinian students, all of the Palestinian students that like the Zionist students knew, like especially the Palestinian students from Palestine, were getting explicit harassment because they knew that they were from Palestine, like from, they knew they were from Palestine. And so all of that was happening. There was also physical assaults happening, people were being shoved, people were being pushed. I knew somebody that got scratched. I knew someone pushed so hard they basically fell down. I think my laptop got like smashed that day at some point, just because like it was just, I don't know, there was a lot going on. Right, and how the administration has even handled the fact that happened. And there were so many observers from faculty and admin present that saw that happen, and they didn't think to do their own investigation on those students. That is another topic. But basically, in response to all of that, the administration was like, okay, we need to, well, actually, at a certain point, it had kind of calmed down in the sense that we had all gone up, the Palestinian protesters, just started doing like a very simple picket. So we were just kind of marching around the lobby to keep people moving, because at first we were sitting down, and like, I mean, the Zionists were literally like stomping near people. Like, it was very much not going to be safe for people to continue to sit down. But we had managed to keep ourselves contained, keep ourselves safe. Like I said, we still had people assigned to marshal, as we were always going to have. And then the administration came down, brought their like lower level admin to like hand out these suspension letters to almost every student in the space, telling them that they need to leave by like 12:15 or else they would be subject to suspension. At which point the counter protesters left, but we were like, you know, no, we're going to stay. And as organized, like the lead organizers, we kind of like huddled up in the corner trying to figure out, you know, like, you know, what are the risks here? You know, what do we want to do after this? And we figured like, we have enough numbers, like we want to stand our ground and do that. And I think that that was definitely a turning point. And it was the first time that the MIT administration really tried to go down on the hammer with like repression. And it was also the first time that we had really come back at them and said, no, like we're not going to leave this space. And so then more people began to come throughout the day as they found out what was happening, both students as well as community members. And we were kind of in like negotiations with admin in the background, because the administration didn't know, like we were prepared if need be to potentially stay the night. Like people were rappelling food down from the second floor. Some people brought in prayer mats. They were praying Maghrib in the back. Like we were, you know, like we could have stayed if we had wanted to, right? And so I think that seeing that level of community come together and that level of numbers was like, admin cannot repress all of us, at least not in this moment. And so that allowed them to back off on suspension threats. And so I think that sort of model is kind of how we've been approaching things. It obviously doesn't always work because, you know, admin will is, you know, going to be determined in its repression. But I think that was the first time that we realized, like, if we have the numbers and if we have the strength, we can kind of go forward. And as the media was kind of going on about this sit-in, we had like other student groups, like the Black Students Union, the Black Graduate Student Association, the Asian American Initiative, the Arab Student Organization, and some other groups like release statements in solidarity with the protests and what we were doing. We've kind of developed this like coalition for Palestine, kind of similar to what folks over at like Columbia and a lot of these other schools have been doing, although I think we only have like 15 or so student groups. And so it's always honestly really cool to see all these like really big coalitions kind of forming at all these different campuses. And so I think having that coalition has also been a way for us to push back against repression. So when we got suspended, the CAA in February, and when we still had the sanction letters, which basically said that not only can you not break another rule because we will permanently suspend you, but in the meantime, until this sanction letter is resolved, you cannot engage in any leadership activities in any clubs. Now, what is a leadership activity? We still don't know, because they were basically categorizing anything as a leadership activity, right? Typically, leadership activity is something like, you know, being the president or treasurer of a club, which in of itself, that was already a very harsh sanction, because we have members who are in the exec of like their cultural organizations or like their social organizations or their discussion groups, like other very, not even political groups that they now were unable to be a part of. And it was kind of effectively taking the most politically active members of our campus and removing them from other parts of campus life. But then on top of that, what we had at the time was, once the Zionists found out that we had these sanctions against us, that we couldn't do these leadership activities, say I'm, you know, tabling. So we have like these like tabling booths that student groups can like reserve, and we would have like a coalition partner that wasn't like the CAA reserve a tabling spot. So maybe MIT Divest, which is like the fossil fuel group, they'll like reserve a tabling spot so that we can still continue to talk about Palestine with these groups that are aligned with us. we would have the Zionists come around, take photos of us at the table, send it to the administration and be like, see, they're still organizing. See that? They're still doing, this is a leadership activity. And then we get pulled into a meeting with administration and they tell us to stop tabling. And we'd have to explain that simply sitting at a table and talking about Palestine is not a leadership activity, nor has it ever been for any other club. And it was just very clear that they hoped that suspending the CAA would just mean that no Palestine, like nobody would be talking about Palestine anymore. You know what I mean? We would have Zionists come up to the table with, like, again, a different student group. Maybe the Black Student Union is the one that has reserved the table that day and other people are tabling. And they'd be like, didn't you guys get suspended? You know, saying like, if we're even talking about Palestine, like they just felt like our suspension should have just solved the problem on campus. You know what I mean? And so I think because we have those coalition partners, it's been really helpful to continue the organizing on campus. So the week after we got suspended, the BSU and the BGSA, so the two Black student groups, held a rally and a disruption of this MLK gala that happens every year. I think this year was like the 50th anniversary, some big anniversary. A lot of administrators go, and you know, it's as expected. I mean, it's a very cool event for the Black community on campus, but there's obviously a lot of hypocrisy with like the president going up and speaking to MLK's legacy of this sort of thing. While also doing that, like there was, it was very hypocritical. And so we did this disruption of this MLK gala, and it was like spearheaded by the BSU and the Black Graduate Student Association. And so again, in that way, we were able to continue to organize, to talk about the genocide in Palestine, to talk about CAA's demands around the research ties, and to also call out admin for this repression without putting like the people who were currently under sanctions at risk at the time. But again, being able to do it through our coalition partners. And more we're seeing that, right? So we are still suspended, but maybe the Asian American Initiative books the room this day, or, you know, we have other groups that are able to do these sorts of things. And so, I think that coalition is what's going to keep us strong going forward. And I think it's made them realize they can't shut us up. Like they really just thought that, like, even the sanctions, you know, I feel like they thought that if they just got rid of the visible leaders, that would be enough to make everything go away. It clearly isn't. I think administration has a skewed view of how many people on campus are pro-Palestine. So I mentioned how like 12% of the undergraduate body has signed on to this pledge. We recently had like an undergraduate referendum, basically calling on the cutting of those research ties that I mentioned before, standing in solidarity with pro-Palestine organizers facing repression, as well as just calling for joining the global call for a ceasefire. And that referendum passed like 2-1. It got like record turnout in a year where like, basically we have like our like class body, like president and vice president elections at the same time. There was nobody running for like any other position. Like the class council positions were like all uncontested except for like one. And the like student body president was also uncontested. So like the only reason people had to vote in this election was for the two referenda that were on the ballot, ours, and there was also an unrelated one. And it got record turnout, like 45% of the student body and undergraduate body at MIT voted, which is very good. Normally it's like 20-something percent. And with that, 1,200 people voted yes on our referendum, which apparently admin thought that there was like 5% of the undergraduates max that might be in solidarity with the CAA. And so I think these sorts of shows just continue to show the administration that like you can try to target like a specific organization or specific leaders, but that's not going to actually do anything for the campus. And like we had our undergraduate one, but now the graduate students are basically doing a similar thing, but through their union, which also adds another layer of protection as like a graduate student union. And so I'm pretty confident that they will be able to get theirs passed as well. It's been a rough battle. They've also had their share of Zionist attacks, and we had a lot of Zionist interference with the undergraduate referendum. There were these trucks roaming around the street during our referendum telling people to vote no, which is just like monetarily is such an insane amount of money to spend to like interfere with like an undergraduate student body election and then to still get completely body slammed with the vote turnout. But yeah, a lot of things I could say, but I think just being creative in the ways that we organize and just showing that like an organization is not just its leaders or even its like leading organization. Like like a movement is much bigger than that. And I think we've shown that despite the suspension of the CAA and the sanctions against individual leaders, like the fact that the movement is still going has shown that this is actually a very broad movement, and it's not something that's only, like, solely determined by the leading figures in it. And I think that shows that we're pretty strong.
Right. Thank you so much, Safia. And CAA is the Coalition Against Apartheid at MIT. And finally, Sabira, you know, I know you're studying abroad, but you're still very much a part of the student body organizing sphere at the University of Pennsylvania. How are students at UPenn organizing and fighting back? And has the atmosphere of repression silenced the movement at all, or how do you see it right now?
You know, amazingly, the short answer is no. It's really interesting because last year was an amazing year for direct action on our campus. And myself, I was put in disciplinary processes for what was happening last year. And last year we were advocating against displacement, which is a theme that is present in the history of Palestinian advocacy, displacement. Again, mentioning the placement of Penn and the Black Bottom, the historic Black Bottom of Philadelphia, and just in general, like the Lenape land in Philadelphia. The university, again, like prides itself on these liberal values, but is very violent towards the actual residents of Philadelphia and the Black community. So last year, there was a lot of repression. Students were targeted in their homes. They were, like, I was suspended from a student group that was totally unaffiliated from the actual, like, protest. It's similar to what Safia had mentioned, that, like, you know, students who are leaders of the political advocacy are removed from student society. They're not allowed to be students. But because we had last year, it was so much more, not easier, but it was more familiar about the repression, because this has happened before. Disruption, direct action is not something new to Penn. There's been a lot of administration changes with Liz McGill, you know, leaving, not even just a year after she was put in our university campus. But to be honest, last year was really difficult for her because we disrupted convocation, you know, her entire inauguration was disrupted. We camped on campus for over 30 days and then, you know, had an amazing action right at the end. You know, Penn students are proud to have, you know, resisted against increased police presence on our campus, against this genocide, against Penn's complicity in, you know, Israeli aggression against Palestinians and its, you know, funding towards apartheid, genocide, and military assistance and innovation towards the settler colonialist project. Penn students are very firm in that, and it's kind of exactly what everyone has said. You can't just target the leaders because there is no leader in our campus. You know, we're all together. We're all students, faculty, staff. You know, it's great to have you know, someone from Harvard Law, because we have a lot of students from Penn Law involved. We have graduate students from every different school at Penn. So it's not just undergrads, it's graduate students, staff, faculty, you know, students from, you know, every single background, you know. So it's really hard to target and suppress the Palestinian, pro-Palestinian and, you know, Palestinian solidarity community on our campus, especially considering, like, it was exactly what Kay said, we have to protect ourselves. And it's not just, you know, Penn Against the Occupation and Freedom School for Palestine that have been leading and assisting with the direct actions and organizing, but Fossil Free Penn against, like, Penn, I'm forgetting the name of the group, but Police Free Penn, all of these adjacent and in solidarity group members have all been putting their hands in. You know, the graduate union, all of us have really been involved because we all recognize that our struggles are united. We can't talk about Palestine. We can't talk about, you know, the displacement of Black community members. We often say from Philadelphia to Palestine, occupation is not justified. And that's really the entire motto of the student body. Obviously, like in conversation with the Zionist community members, because, you know, Zionist presence on our campus is very loud, with, you know, us having over 5 Zionist groups. And before Freedom School for Palestine, that was born out of what was happening in October, Panic Against the Occupation was actually really, really repressed when it just started. And it wasn't even that radical. You know, we started off with the two-sidedism, you know, just talking points and walking around that. But now we have really grown into stronger and more firm stances about what freedom for Palestine actually looks like. So this isn't new. Repression isn't new, and it's not scary for any of us. It's more of like it affirms our community, it affirms that we don't find liberation within these elite institutions, although many of us are grateful to be part of these institutions. You know, myself included, being an FGLI student, we recognize that it is a privilege to be in these spaces, but it's not a privilege. It's not justified to use that privilege to, you know, be complicit in what the university, you know, wants itself to stand for. You know, as these students, we are in a unique position, especially within the city of Philadelphia, that, you know, Penn doesn't pay any taxes. It like actively displaces Black Philadelphians. It, you know, it's just very, very toxic to the community. And being from Philadelphia myself, I've grown up in the city. You know, I have myself faced displacement and eviction from Penn, and it's encroaching real estate into my community. We all recognize that privilege of being at Penn makes us, you know, directly involved, directly, you know, pioneers in the sense that we need to be the ones who speak up. We need to be the ones who are not scared in the eyes of repression. You know, many students actually have 3 or more disciplinary cases. And that's insane. You know, us being at a university that has, you know, such hard course load and being involved in multiple societies, we're battling three or more disciplinary cases. And the fact that students are still showing up to the same direct actions, who are still, you know, wearing the keffiyeh, like, you know, with a smile on their face, don't care about the fact that they're going to get dirty looks from other students who are speaking up in classrooms, you know, because, you know, if like we keep the discussion going, we don't let the genocide be just on our phones, just within the confinements of Instagram or whatever it is. Students are not scared. And despite, you know, these congressional hearings and Liz McGill resigning and now us getting like an interim president and everything changing, you know, the board of trustees, like all this movement in the university, we just know that, you know, whenever someone comes in, you know, they don't know what to expect because Liz McGill had a hell of a year. And we know how to protect ourselves. We know how to advocate. We know how to speak up. And it's not just the Penn community that's behind us. It's the entire city, because it's not just us who are leading, you know, the fight. It's Palestinians back at home for being resilient in their identities and their existence. But it's also just the entire Philadelphia community that has eyes on Penn. Because we see through their lies. We see them talking to us privately. You know, I've gotten emails after the threats to my own family being like, I'm so sorry. Can we do anything? And then, you know, my friends being targeted on, you know, campus for putting stickers on and just having like being identifiable, you know, they know who some of us are, but they don't know how big we are, if that makes sense. And that's across not just my campus, but everyone's campus. And it should show universities that, you know, you can spread lies, you can spread this propaganda, you can feed into the Zionist talking points and institution and the lies about what, you know, freedom for Palestine actually looks like, but the actual students know, because we got into this university for being smart and for being advocates and for being, you know, pioneers and the actual true believers of what freedom looks like. And, you know, if you accepted us based on that, then what were you expecting when you did all this respectfully shit, you know? Yeah.
That's perfectly said. Well, thank you so much, Sabira. You're an organizer at the University of Pennsylvania. Safia, you're at MIT and you're with the Coalition Against Apartheid. Kay, you're at Columbia University and Columbia University Apartheid Divest. And Leah, you are at Harvard Law School's Students for Justice in Palestine. This has been an extraordinary and such an important discussion to have. And I thank you, each of you, for all that you're doing, for all the strength that you are engaging in and embodying with these protests and this organizing and just, you know, the tenacity and steadfastness. And I know that our audience is very appreciative of all the work that you're all doing individually and collectively. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.